The following program is brought to you by your friends at Podcast One. Don't forget to download our new Podcast One app.
Don't you wish your beauty, home, and wellness products could ship straight to your door? Now they can with FabFitFun. They're a seasonal subscription box delivered four times a year with full-size beauty, fashion, home, fitness, and wellness products for just $49.99 a box. And now, the 2019 FabFitFun Spring Box is on sale. I'm a big fan of the Wild Rose Night Cream. It smells amazing, and I wake up with my skin feeling soft and smooth. They have full-size products, and every box is guaranteed to have over $200 in retail value, and many products' individual value is more than the entire cost of the box. Sign up for FabFitFun today. These boxes always sell out. Use the code COLD to get $10 off your first box. Go to FabFitFun.com to sign up and start getting the box for a life well lived. Use the promo code COLD, C-O-L-D, to get $10 off your first box. That's over $200 for only $39.99. Go to FabFitFun.com and use the code COLD to get $10 off your first FabFitFun box. Hi, it's Brooke. This week, we have a classic cold case episode for you. But before I start, I should warn you. This episode contains graphic descriptions of violence against children. Some of it is really hard to hear. In Akron, Ohio, two little girls went missing. The first disappeared in January of 1995. Then, almost exactly a year later, the second girl was taken. The response was almost identical in both cases. The family searched for hours, believing the girls might have taken a wrong turn or lost track of time at a friend's house. Eventually, though, they had to admit their worst fears and call the police to report the girls missing. From A&E, this is Cold Case Files. I'm Brooke, and here's the illustrious Bill Curtis with a classic case, Abandoned Houses.
When she made me that promise and the look in her eyes to tell me that she would be back before it got dark, I believed her.
On a winter's night, 13-year-old Melissa Thomas promises her mother she'll be home before dark. Darkness falls, and there's no sign of Melissa. Family and friends hit the streets of West Akron.
Just searching, looking, asking questions, stopping people on the street and, doing whatever we could to try to find her.
After hours of searching, Sonia Merchant calls police.
Actually, I took a report from her, but yes. Still the grandmother was too...
The next day, Officer Bertina King gets the case and recognizes the name immediately. She stops first at the home of Melissa's sister, the last person to see Melissa.
We're at 710 Westerly Road, Apartment F. This is where I took the missing persons report on Melissa Thomas. Went all through here, knocking on some doors, asking anybody I see, do you know who Melissa is? What we're looking for, telling people what she had on. And we put out like a bolo. We put it out on all the channels, what she looked like, who we're looking for. And I stopped at all the businesses up Wooster Avenue and let them know she was missing.
For days, there is no sign of Melissa.
I was trying to think that nothing bad was happening. I was hoping that maybe, she was with somebody and hoping that she would just come back.
Me and my partner were working on the house, and I went to the second floor.
On January 26th, John Redd is cleaning up an abandoned house on East Avenue.
I was walking down that hallway and I discovered a body. It was a dead 13-year-old girl.
Red runs next door for help. Moments later, Detective Washington Lacey is on the scene.
First thing on my mind was, we're in trouble. That was the first thing, we're in trouble, because it just, that type of thing just doesn't happen every day in Akron. She was bound both hands and feet. You could see just from looking at her, she had material in her mouth, and she had like I said, it was obvious that she was pulling. She had pulled this material away from her her bindings.
A teenager trying to bite herself free. It's an image that touches even the toughest of detectives.
And there was a little tear coming out of her right eye, and that didn't help the situation either.
The body is ID'd as Melissa Thomas. A short time later, a mother's phone rings.
They identified the body, and I lost it. You see this type of stuff happen to everybody else. You see it on TV, you see it everywhere else, but and you never think that it would hit home. I can't believe this. I couldn't believe it. You know, why?
Melissa Thomas was strangled to death. Semen is also recovered from her body. Despite the forensic leads, no suspects are developed.
We just didn't know. Just kept running into dead end.
Melissa's case falls into the cold files, and a child killer remains at large on the streets of West Akron.
I had to go to traffic court that night, and she was going to go with me.
Pat Huffman has a 7 p.m. date in traffic court. Pat's 12-year-old stepdaughter, Rosie, plans to join her. Rosie promises to be home by 6.
And she says, I'll be back. She says, I'm going to go to court with you. And she was all excited about going to traffic court. So it comes 6 o'clock, and no Rosie. 6:15, still no Rosie. 6:30, no Rosie.
Pat and Rosie's father, Jerry, search the neighborhood for hours.
We had a big picture window in the apartment, and he sat there looking out that window saying, Rosie's going to be coming up here any minute now. We're going to see Rosie any minute. And he sat there looking out that window all night long, and still no Rosie.
The family files a missing persons report, then considers the worst.
I knew in my heart then, it just something told me she wasn't coming home no more, because it wasn't like Rosie to do that. And I told Jerry, I says, you know, I says, hope for the best, but I says, I have a bad feeling. And he says, what do you mean? I said, I don't think Rosie's coming back anymore.
Well, right now we're standing beside property 154 South Maple, heading back to 156 South Maple, which is no longer here.
On March 5th, 1996, Michael Johnson cleans up his latest purchase, a duplex on South Maple Street.
I had a trash bag with me, and I reached down and grabbed a handful of clothes. It was just trash everywhere. And that's when I turned around, and that's when I saw her leg. Well, I ran upstairs, called 911, and told them, I think I found a dead body.
We were dispatched to 156 South Maple, roughly a little after 5 o'clock.
Akron police officer Mike Stover drives up minutes after the call.
We're outside of 156 South Maple, which was the scene of the homicide. We get to the bottom of the stairs, and they said that underneath some clothing they had found her. I looked over, and as you can see there, immediately there's a red line across the throat of the young lady. That was the first thing that jumped out at me.
Stover tapes off the crime scene and calls homicide. Police suspect the victim may be Rosie Davenport. A knock on Pat Huffman's door confirms it.
I knew it was the police. I opened the door and he showed me a badge. And he says, did you report a little girl missing? I said, yeah. He said, could you tell me, was she wearing a Garfield watch? And I said, yes. And I knew then that they had found her. He said, well, we just found her body. I mean, that was heartbreaking.
Okay, I just transferred to the unit, the Crimes Against Persons Unit, and this was my second day on the job.
Jerry Kelly takes the lead on the case and works with a team of detectives. They attend the autopsy on what would have been Rosie Davenport's 13th birthday.
The evidence from the sexual assault was that it was very brutal, very painful.
Very strong memories from this one because the victim was so terrorized, was so innocent. Was a victim with a capital V. You know, this girl should have been out roller skating the next day with her friends. She shouldn't have been lying in the basement. mutilated, strangled, and raped and murdered.
We knew we were dealing with a monster. So what we need to do is, you know, to get busy and do our homework and get out there, beat the streets, and find out who did it. We're on South Maple Street. Actually, one of our last spottings of Rosie on Saturday was in this area.
Detectives find their first lead at the last place Rosie was seen, the home of Michelle Lindsay and her live-in boyfriend, Dondi Craig.
She was visiting Michelle Lindsay, who has several daughters of Rosie's age, and it was sort of a gathering place for a lot of the kids there.
I didn't like her walking home because she was too little.
At that time, Michelle Lindsay told us that Dondi Craig and his brother, Dwayne, was going to offer Rosie a ride because they didn't like her walking down the street after dark.
And it was too dark for her to walk home by herself. So that's the reason why I offered her a cab.
Michelle said that Rosie declined the offer, said she'd be fine, and left. A few moments later, Michelle said that Dondi, her live-in boyfriend, left the house as well, and she hadn't seen him since. The next thing we did was, of course, talk to Dondi Craig. He denied any knowledge of knowing Rosie Davenport, said he never saw the girl, doesn't know of her, never had any contact with her.
Dondi said that, but Dondi seen her. Dondi met her. She was in the same house with Dondi. He stayed with us, so I don't know why he want to sit and say he never met her, because he was in the same house.
When Dondi Craig refuses a polygraph, police dig a little deeper and find suspicious activity in Craig's criminal history.
There were very similar cases where it involved abandoned houses, it involved being tied up in sexual assaults. That's kind of like the old ding, 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 ding. You know, the red flags come up, you know, the pointers start pointing. Like I said, it goes right to the top of the list.
Smith returns to Craig's apartment, looking to prove his case.
We wanted to have a sample of his blood for DNA testing. Initially said he would do that, then he changed his mind. So now we were at the point where Dondi Craig was really looking as a strong suspect.
Dondi Craig is arrested after refusing to provide his DNA. After a night in the lockup, he consents to a blood draw. Craig's DNA samples and the evidence are shipped to the DNA lab. But before testing begins, a problem arises.
The problem that we had is the delay in finding Rosie. You know, we were talking 48 hours, maybe up to 72 hours by the time she had died and by the time she had been found. The sperm evidence had already started to break down or deteriorate.
Lab analysts are unable to develop a DNA profile from the semen evidence. With no physical evidence tying Dondi Craig to the crime, police are unable to press charges.
We did not have enough evidence to make charges against him. We had our police instinct, but you know that won't win you a case in court.
As the months pass, little develops on Rosie Davenport's case. Detectives reluctantly set aside the case. Forgetting it, however, is another matter.
There's some cases that just won't ever leave. Well, to me, this was the case. I'll never forget Rosie. I'll never forget that autopsy. We've had a lot of cold cases in our city that's been around for a lot of years. The one that we wanted to solve real bad was this one.
The rest of the case, after this. One of the most important things we do for our health every day is brushing our teeth. Yet most of us don't do it properly. Quip is a better electric toothbrush that was designed to make brushing your teeth more simple, affordable, and enjoyable. The Quip toothbrush has a built-in 2-minute timer that pulses every 30 seconds to remind you when to switch sides. It has a multi-use cover that mounts to your mirror for on-the-go brushing. Quip brush heads are automatically delivered on a dentist-recommended schedule every 3 months for just $5. It has thousands of verified 5-star reviews, and it's one of the first electric toothbrushes accepted by the American Dental Association. I love Quip because of the sensitive sonic vibrations. They're gentle enough on my sensitive gums. That's why I love Quip, and that's why they're backed by 20,000 dental professionals. Quip starts at just $25, and if you go to getquip.com/coldcase right now, you get your first refill pack for free with a Quip electric toothbrush. That's your first refill pack free at getquip.com/coldcase. Hiring is challenging, but there's one place you can go where hiring is simple, fast, and smart. A place where growing businesses connect to qualified candidates. That place is ZipRecruiter.com/coldcase. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards, but they don't stop there. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and invite them to apply to your job. As applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each one and spotlights the top candidates, so you never miss a great match. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 80% of employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through the site within the first day. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/coldcase. That's ZipRecruiter.com/coldcase. ZipRecruiter.com/coldcase. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. The violent murders of Melissa Thomas and Rosie Davenport were impossible to forget. The sheer brutality of the crimes left its mark. So it was the kind of case that never faded away. It never got easier for the families, and the officers knew that somewhere a child murderer was free, out on the streets. Investigators even had a likely suspect, but without a solid genetic sample, they couldn't arrest him. And without a single witness or any other physical evidence, officers were forced to shelve the investigation. The case file would stay on that shelf for another 6 years, until a cold case detective decided to take another crack at the crime scene evidence.
The initial step was to come down here and locate the evidence with Rosie. Everything down this row is like murderer's row.
Detective Jim Pisilich is working overtime in Akron's evidence locker. Grant money is paying for DNA testing on unsolved cases.
This is where these cases are won or lost. This is what we're looking for, is how good a job did we do back then at collecting? Storage-wise, is it still good? Can we still use it?
The first case he pulls is one of only two unsolved child murders in Akron. Her name is Rosie Davenport. 6 years earlier, the 12-year-old was found raped and strangled.
I mean, there was something we were looking for that semen, what was present and left behind by the person that both kidnapped her, raped, and killed her.
Up on a shelf, Pisilich finds Rosie's rape kit. Inside it, hopefully, a DNA profile.
The swabs. The swabs that were obtained at the medical examiner's office in 1996. If you can get that DNA and get them to try to explain how that DNA got there, and in this case, there's no good reason. You got a 12-year-old girl, how did your DNA get inside of her? There's no good reason.
Pisilich sends the swabs to the DNA lab, along with samples from several identified suspects. Of special interest to Pisilich, an uncooperative suspect named Donald Craig.
Donnie was the number one suspect from day one. There just wasn't enough to charge him with back at that time.
When we start the DNA extraction process, we'll take a tube and open it and cut a portion of the sample.
In August of 2002, forensic scientist Linda Eveleth tests evidence from Rosie Davenport's rape kit and isolates two distinct DNA profiles.
Two DNA profiles. It was consistent with Rosanna Davenport and Donald Craig.
We're happy. The arrest is coming. It's not a matter of if it is, it's only when.
Dundee Craig is easy to find. He's in prison on an unrelated charge. Before approaching him, cold case detectives work up a little background on their suspect.
We start looking back through police reports. We find a case in 1991 where he was arrested for raping a 17-year-old girl.
The 17-year-old is LaVale Calhoun. Her case file reads like a blueprint for the attack on Rosie Davenport. The only apparent difference, this victim lived to tell her story.
And that's a face I'll never forget.
In 1991, Dondi Craig visits LaVale Calhoun's house with some friends. LaVale agrees to drive with him for fast food.
He wanted to make a stop. He said he was house sitting for somebody. And he wanted to make a stop and check on the house. So we get through the front door. And he was like, wait right here. I said, why is it dark? You know? And as I turned to grab the doorknob, he threw a sheet over me. I mean, I was just screaming. Started screaming. And he was like, shut up. Be quiet or I'm going to kill you. And he picked me up, carried me up the steps. He threw me down on this bed. He got up on my back and pinned me down, tied both of my hands to the bed, bet not move. I couldn't scream no more. Had tape on my mouth. After he tied my hands to the bed, he took my clothes off and he raped me there. It seemed like hours. It really did. I really thought I was gonna die. I really did. I really did.
LaVale is eventually untied and allowed to dress. Donald Craig then drives his victim home, but not before making one more stop.
He went through the drive-thru before he took me home. And then he dropped me off. I jumped out of that car so fast, and I ran to the house and I told my mother what happened.
Craig is charged with rape and goes to jail, only to be released a short time later.
I thought he was in jail. I went to court twice, testified, and I thought he was in jail.
The ball got dropped in at the grand jury level. Somebody dropped the ball for LaVale Calhoun. The detective who was assigned the case was on vacation, so they never heard from the detective in this case. It should have been picked up by the next grand jury. I mean, that's what it comes down to. It fell through the cracks.
LaVale Calhoun might have fallen through the cracks. She will, however, get her day in court on the witness stand in Rosie Davenport's murder trial. Before detectives take the case to court, they take it to prison, where Dondi Craig is finishing up a 7-year stretch for arson.
I know that he had no idea that we were looking into this case.
Here's my question to you, Dondi. Is there any reason your DNA should be inside of
him? We're at the Belmont Corrections Institute, Belmont, Ohio.
In January of 2003, Dondi Craig is in prison when he gets an unexpected visit from detectives.
Yeah, make a mistake. You try to befriend him when you first go in there. I mean, the easy question you start with, you know, do you even know who Rosie is?
You remember staying at that house over there? I think it was on Maple Street?
Yeah, I remember.
Remember the incident that we're talking about? Rosie Davenport?
After 45 minutes of easy back and forth, detectives begin to tighten up on their suspect.
There was a certain point in time where you have to hit him with the science and says, we know you did it. And then that's when it really escalated.
Okay, point blank questions, because you know we have to ask. Did you kill Rosie?
No, I didn't.
Did you rape Rosie?
No.
Did you have sex with Rosie?
No.
After the expected denials, detectives confront Dondi with some science.
Here's my question to you, Dondi. Is there any reason your DNA should be inside of
it? If my DNA was in there, they would have found that out.
It's the whole reason we're here now.
Yeah.
Your DNA is inside of Rosie.
How can they be to do that? Because I ain't got no knowledge of the girl.
Dondi.
Again, he still denies everything. He knows now why we're down there. He knows we have DNA. We're coming down there for a reason. He still denies it.
Straight up, your DNA was inside Rosie.
Okay, that the case? Let's go to court with him.
Okay.
And that's what we did. We went to court with him. This was the courtroom that Rosie Davenport's case was tried in.
In June of 2004, Dondi Craig goes on trial for kidnapping, rape, and aggravated murder.
Dondi Craig was the last person to see her, and his face was the last face that Rosie Davenport saw.
DNA evidence, coupled with LaVale Calhoun's testimony, makes for a compelling case.
We, the jury in this case, find the defendant, Donald Lavelle Craig, guilty of the offense.
He was found guilty on all charges, the kidnapping, the rape, and the murder of Rosie Davenport.
It still goes through my mind all the time, why? Why a baby? Because that's all Rosie was. He didn't even give her a chance for life.
He's the devil. He's the devil. They ought to bring back the electric chair just for him.
July 22nd, 2004. Dondi Craig is sentenced to death by lethal injection. Rosie Davenport's homicide is officially closed, her files packed away. The investigation into Craig, however, continues.
I think back in the back of our minds, we thought we'd be talking to Dondi again.
I brought him here to a room similar to this one, and he and I, we talked for about an hour.
In 2004, Detective Gary Shady interviews a jailhouse informant who says a fellow inmate might be good for an unsolved murder from 1995.
He specifically told me that the young girl was killed in the west side of Akron, that she had been raped, that she was tied up, and that she had been strangled manually.
Shady asks around about the case and is quickly handed the file of Melissa Thomas, a 13-year-old raped and murdered in 1995.
So I started putting pieces together and said, well, someone is giving him some information that's pretty reliable.
The tipster refuses to give up the name of the suspect. Instead, he leaves the detective work to Shady.
Once I ran him into Summit County Jail, pulled up his housing, I realized Donald Craig was also in his unit.
Shady heads straight to the desk of the man who put Craig away for another child murder.
I came to you because you were working on Roseanne, and I'm like, hey man, this sounds like the same person.
You're right, though. They're exactly the same. You just change the names of the victims. You change Rosie and Melissa, you can interchange them. They're exactly the same.
In December of 2005, semen evidence recovered during Melissa Thomas's autopsy is compared with Dondi Craig's DNA. The result? A perfect match.
I was jumping out of my chair. I really was.
With that, Dondi Craig is charged. 8 months later, he goes to trial. In the summer of 2006, Donald Craig is found guilty of a second crime against a child, the rape and murder of Melissa Thomas. On August 16th, Craig returns to court for sentencing.
All right, let the record show the sentencing of Donald L. Craig.
Craig's sentencing begins with statements from the victim's family.
To you, Donald Craig, I just want you to know that you caused us a lot of sleepless nights. You caused me a lot of painful days. And I miss my baby that you took from me. And you sit there and you don't make amends and you don't act like you did anything to anybody. But I just want you to know that God bless you and may he bless your soul. But I am so glad that you can't hurt anybody else's child.
Thank you, ma'am. Thank you, Reverend. Mr. Craig, please stand. Hereby sentence you to be taken to the Ohio Department of Corrections and be put to death for that murder.
No emotion crosses Dondi Craig's face as he receives his second death sentence. Behind him, however, Melissa Thomas's family is overjoyed. Outside the courtroom, a grateful mother offers open arms to the detectives who worked the case.
We didn't forget about you. We never forget about anybody.
Sure did.
We don't forget. We don't forget.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
There's one last stop for Sonia Merchant and her family. A visit to Melissa's memorial on East Avenue, across the street from where Melissa's body was found. It's a place to remember and to pray.
Father, I ask that you grab my baby and that you hug her and you kiss her and you tell her that we love her and she will always forever be in our hearts, Lord, in Jesus' name. Amen. Amen. I know that Melissa can rest in peace. She will never be forgotten. Never. She will always be here. But we can go on with our lives now.
I have to give the families a lot of credit in this case. I don't know that I could ask for blessings on behalf of a person who viciously murdered someone I loved. It seemed like they found peace rather than vengeance in Craig's death sentence. That's because it meant he wouldn't be able to murder another innocent child. And to that end, the sentence stuck. Donald Craig was never executed by lethal injection, but he also never saw freedom again. Craig died in 2012 after spending 7 months in a prison hospital for an undisclosed illness. He was 52 years old. Cold Case Files, the podcast, is hosted by Brooke Giddings. Produced by McKamey Lynn and Steve Delamater, our executive producer is Ted Butler. We're distributed by Podcast One. Cold Case Files Classic was produced by Curtis Productions and hosted by the one and only Bill Curtis. Check out more Cold Case Files at aetv.com or learn more about cases like this one by visiting the A&E Real Crime blog at aetv.com/realcrime.